customers did not actually lose money. The judge also said Bankman-Fried lied during his trial testimony when he said he did not know that his hedge fund had spent customer deposits taken from FTX. Federal prosecutors had sought a prison sentence of 40 to 50 years. And in weather today, it is 51 degrees with light showers. From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Hey, welcome to the Labor Heritage Power Hour, a weekly radio show celebrating the cultural heritage of the American worker. We're a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. I'm Chris Garlock with Elise Bryant. Elise, you took your one-woman show to Ann Arbor last week. How'd it go?
It went really well, Chris. It was a reunion of friends and family by choice, who I've done theater with in the past. So the audience response was very, very strong. I love the feedback. But the consensus was, again, it's a one-woman show, not a group show, not an ensemble show.
We've all been telling you that it must be true. So next stop, Broadway?
No, next stop, Detroit. In fact, Southwest Detroit, where I grew up. Rick Sperling, who's worked with Mosaic Theater for years, suggested the Matrix Theater, which is located in Southwest Detroit.
Fabulous. All right, folks, stay tuned, especially those of you in Detroit. And speaking of plays, we are on a bit of a theater roll. Last week, of course, you remember we talked to Laura Neal, the REI worker who's written a play about organizing a union at her store in New York City. This week, we've got another play featuring workers, and I know, Elise, you got your start in worker theater.
Yes, Workers' Lives, Worker Stories.
So you are going to love this. It's called Changing Lives, Changing LA. It's a play created from transcripts from the Unite Here Local 11 Oral History Project and portrayed by professional actors. Four members of Unite Here Local 11 share their stories of becoming leaders in their union and fighting for a better life while helping transform Los Angeles. And it comes to us from our colleagues at the always terrific Rework podcast.
That's wonderful. It's telling our stories, the stories of working people, is absolutely needed right now more than ever. I look forward to it.
We're also going to visit with Rosemarie Francis Primo, a home healthcare aide from Brooklyn and a proud member of Domestic Workers United. That's from the America Works podcast.
What a perfect way to end Women's History Month.
And on Labor History in Two.
The year was 1947. That was the day Centralia Coal Mine Number 5 exploded, killing 111 miners in Centralia, Illinois.
Before we get to the show, Chris, I believe you have some big news to share.
Oh, yes, indeed, Elise. After months, I said months of work, the Labor Heritage Foundation has launched, drumroll please, our new website. You can check it out, laborheritage.org. It's got all the latest labor arts news, tons of cool labor arts events across the country. Plus, just launched, you can now get LHF merch, t-shirts, caps, mugs, tote bags, with the brand new LHF logo. And there's more. We also released this year's DC Labor Film Fest schedule, which launches on May Day.
Whew. That's a lot.
We've been busy.
It's a good thing.
All right. We're going to start off today's show with something that's actually ripped right from the headlines, but which turns out to have a deep connection to labor history. Any guesses what that might be? I give you a clue. You were there yesterday.
Oh, the Supreme Court?
In one, she gets it in one. So this is a case that was argued before the Supreme Court last week. This is National Rifle Association versus VULO. which is basically a censorship-free speech case. And I know you and all our listeners are probably wondering, what the heck does this have to do with labor history, right?
Right. So tell us.
Well, I did not know. That's why I called up labor historian Joe McCartan to explain. So should we give that a listen? Yeah. So let's give that a listen. I guess first we need to start out with what I think a lot of people are sort of confused about. Why is the ACLU defending the National Rifle Association? So can you kind of do a idiot's guide to that?
Sure. So why is the ACLU representing the NRA? It's a good question. but actually, if you study history, it's not all that surprising in some ways. The ACLU had its origins in the World War I years. It grew out of the left-wing opposition to the U.S. entry into the war and people who were trying to prevent that. And once we entered the war, it became focused on defending the rights of those who didn't want to be drafted, for example, who challenged the draft, who were conscientious objectors. It also defended the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which formally never took a position against the war, but many of its activists did actively. And a bunch of them were arrested, put on trial, and convicted under the Espionage Act. So that was the crucible within which the ACLU was formed in those years where civil liberties were really in danger. Now, the first leader of the organization was a guy named Roger Baldwin. And actually, Baldwin, in his early years, had been involved with the IWW when he lived in St. Louis. And he was very much enamored of the IWW's free speech fights, which took place between around 1910 and 1912 in several cities like San Diego, like Fresno, in which the IWW was trying to organize agricultural workers outside of those cities. And they encountered city ordinances that forbid them from basically having public meetings. And so they decided to openly challenge those ordinances by just climbing up on soapboxes on street corners, speaking to workers, fellow worker, you know, and giving an impromptu speech. They'd be quickly arrested. Somebody else would climb up on the box, and pretty soon they'd fill the local jail. Baldwin watched that, and he thought that was heroic, and it would serve an introduction to him to the defense of civil liberties. And when World War I came around, he became involved before the U.S. entered in a group called American Union Against Militarism, which was against U.S. entry. And then once we were in the war, he became involved in the defense of civil liberties. So the American Union Against Militarism created a Civil Liberties Bureau that separated from it and later became the National Civil Liberties Bureau and then involved into the ACLU. So you could say at the beginning that the ACLU had close ties to labor struggle in that way. But from the beginning, the ACLU's defense of civil liberties really focused on speech. And often individual speech. And, you know, the defense that the ACLU has made around civil liberties over the years is that civil liberties need to be protected. The minority speech needs to be protected from the majority, being able to suppress it. And if you think about it that way, you can see a line that runs right through to the present and to the ACLU's involvement with the NRA. And in between, you know, the founding years and where we're currently at, there were several occasions where there was real tension evident between the ACLU's approach and thinking and, say, what people in the labor movement believed. Like, for example, When the Wagner Act was proposed in 1935, Roger Baldwin was against it. He believed this is going to be a government effort to regulate how unions get formed, and he wanted no part of that. It actually caused a lot of internal dissension within the ACLU. There were other people that said, that's a crazy way to think about this. Of course, we need, you know, this act to protect workers' rights to organize and bargain collectively. In the end, Baldwin had to sort of back down from his position, and he did. And by the World War II years, the ACLU had not only moved away from that early sort of suspicion of the Wagner Act to a kind of embrace of the rights that it conferred, to the point that when the Taft-Hartley Act was passed in 1947, trying to weaken the Wagner Act, the ACLU actually urged Truman to veto it, which Truman did, but then, you know, he was overridden, of course. But to get back to this tension at the heart of things, right after World War II, the NAACP, the organization that began the long fight for civil rights, initiated a national boycott of the Amos and Andy radio program, right? They, you know, were justifiably outraged that that very popular radio program, in which it employed only white actors, by the way, who sort of impersonated in a kind of blackface minstrelsy way, black characters, in a way that was very stereotyped and prejudiced and racist. The NAACP urged that people boycott the show and put pressure on the advertisers to the show. The ACLU thought that that was a mistake. It opposed it. And it believed that, you know, you shouldn't try to stifle speech in this way by using collective action, in this case, a boycott. So over time, the ACLU sort of backed away from that kind of thinking as well. But, you know, its early opposition to the Wagner Act, or its feeling that a boycott is a dangerous thing, if you think about those things, it helps explain how it arrives at this position defending the NRA. In the case of New York, the ACLU became concerned that the state was actively lobbying for groups not to do business with the NRA. And although the ACLU, I think, has never really been a great defender of the Second Amendment that the NRA is all concerned about, it saw that kind of state intervention as a kind of dangerous thing. And so it finds itself on that side of the case. So the long history of the ACLU kind of explains how this could come about. And even though it began, as the kind of organization it was led by radicals. Baldwin was a radical. It can, following that logic, end up in this place.
I mean, you've got an organization that gets started defending the IWW for speaking out against the war. I'm assuming because, you know, the IWW stand that the wars are fought by the working class folks for the rich, and that we're fighting against each other. So perfectly reasonable. But then the labor movement, I mean, we believe in collective action. So whether it's a boycott, right, or a rally, you could probably reel off a half a dozen examples. I mean, without collective action, what are we? Right.
Exactly.
And so I find myself really conflicted, because on the one hand, it makes sense to me that we're not allowed to yell fire in a crowded theater. And it makes sense that the government should be able to say, you know, you can't put out misinformation about COVID, or ivermectin is a good thing. That seems to make sense to me. On the other hand, I don't want the government prosecuting, you know, labor folks, right? So I find myself kind of honestly confused by this.
Well, I think that's natural. And I think it's the best response here, because you're able to hold two different thoughts in place here, which I think is the appropriate thing to do. I think it is confusing Honestly, in this case, I hope that the ACLU loses it, because I think it's important that we, in the interest of the common good, push back against how the NRA has really undermined our sense of physical safety in our society now, with all the shootings we've had and all of their opposition to any regulation. But it gets at really what's true, I think, Chris, in any democracy that really is functional, is that there will always be a tension between majority rule and minority rights. And that's a good thing. The problem is when minority rights start to trump majority rule. And indeed, I think we've started to see that in recent years. There's an interesting concept that some people in the law have started to point out about recent years, the direction of the Supreme Court in the use of the First Amendment to knock down majority rule, to undermine regulation. And they've given a very interesting term to this approach, and they call it First Amendment Lochnerism. And for any of your listeners who know the Lochner case, that was a 1905 Supreme Court case which dominated and destroyed, you know, basically any regulatory approach to labor relations before the New Deal, because it said that almost any kind of government regulation of the workplace, like setting a minimum wage, setting, you know, hours of labor, that was an infringement on the liberty of contract between the employer and the employee. The state should not interfere with that liberty. And by holding to this kind of arcane and kind of detached from the real world position, as the court did for years, the court knocked down efforts to ban child labor, for example. It knocked down efforts to set minimum wages for working women, which it tried to do, which was tried in several states. Basically, it undercut all of the will of the majority of people who said, we've got labor problems in this country. It's not a good thing when children are being forced out of the home instead of school to work to support their families. We need to stop this. And the court repeatedly invoked this doctrine to undermine it. And sadly, we've seen in recent years, the Supreme Court is applying that same kind of, fixated logic, you might say, to the labor questions of our time. The approach that overturned Lochnerism was called legal realism, because it was advanced by people who are like, this is not the way the world actually works. You talk about liberty of contract, but one side has all the power to make a contract. The other is like forced into a contract. Otherwise, they starve.
Right.
So like, what kind of liberty is that? So, realism is required. And I think, unfortunately, you know, the court today is populated by, you know, six ideologues who, you know, really have almost no real interaction with the real world. And never did.
Well, Joe, it's a thorny thicket, and I appreciate you taking some time to bring some light to help us sort of cut through this. So appreciate it.
Always, Chris.
Hey, this is Chris Garlock from Labor History Today. We're proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, more than 200 labor radio and podcast shows across the country and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where the people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
And you're listening to Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM. Our next segment today is from Rework Radio, a woman-led radio show and podcast from UCLA Labor Center, spotlighting the voices of workers, immigrants, and people of color.
Hi everyone, this is Vina. Today we're doing something a little different. We're sharing a play called Changing Lives, Changing LA. It was created from transcripts from the Unite Here Local 11 Oral History Project and was originally performed before a live audience at Loyola Marymount University and UCLA. You're going to hear from four members of Unite Here Local 11 who are voiced by professional actors, Emma Worthington, Ignacio Ruiz, Regla Soto, and Soledad Garcia share their stories of becoming leaders in their union and fighting for a better life while helping transform Los Angeles. We open with Emma.
The first time I got arrested was for Local 11. I got arrested when they were doing the housekeeper strike. I think it was the Wilshire Grand. We got handcuffed to a truck in the middle of Wilshire Boulevard. That was my first arrest. Well, after that, I was hooked on doing demonstrations, that is. You have to learn to stand up and fight for yourself, but you can't do it by yourself. It has to be a group effort.
My name is Ignacio Ruiz. I grew up over in Mexico in the state of Michoacán. When I was 7 years old, already I was working in the field with one of my uncles. I was performing the same job as a grown-up person, but he was paying me different wages because of my age. So I went over and talked to my uncle, and I say, "You're paying these workers 10 pesos, and I'm getting 5 pesos for the same work, performing the same duties that they do. Why is it that I'm not getting paid the same?" He didn't agree on paying me the same wages. So I say, "Okay, I'm not working any longer with you." And I went over and tell my father, "You know what? I don't think this is fair." So I left. Then after 2 weeks or so, my uncle calls me back and says, "Okay, I'm going to pay you the same as the others." So I went back. I delegated my uncle when I was 7, and I got it. So ever since, I know that if you stand up, you get what you deserve.
Well, I am Regla Soto. I am Cuban from the city of La Habana. I was raised poor. Well, I have always been poor. I grew up, got married, had 3 kids. I came from Cuba to Miami. I came from Cuba with my 3 kids and my husband. We came through the sea in a really small boat. They put more people in the boat than it could take. I remember that I saw a boat that was sinking, and the boat I was in kept on going. I saw a lot of people drown. They would throw out people from the boats for the weight, so not to sink. You could see the hands of the people who were screaming, and I kept going. I kept going because you have to keep going. I don't like to talk about that. They put us in a refuge that was called Base Chrome. I was there for about 2 months with my husband and my kids. And a church took us in, a Lutheran church. And they took us to Minneapolis. We were there for 2 years. But the snow was harmful to my kids. They had bloody noses all the time, and I had a lot of problems based on the climate. So we arrived in California. I had some time without working until I found work over there in the Westin.
You're listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
Revolutionary radio for revolutionary times. Back now to Changing Lives, Changing LA, a play created from transcripts from the Unite Here Local 11 Oral History Project and brought to us by Rework Radio.
My name is Soledad Garcia. I don't remember what number I am in the family, but we're a total of 9. I'm the last girl in the family. We had a very hard life, a very poor life. My parents, they both work so hard to put food on the table. It's either we eat or buy clothes or pay bills. I didn't like that kind of life. when I started to learn the world a little bit, I started to want to do something different, to be different from my sisters. They say they got married very early to get out of the house. I didn't want to get married because I saw they were repeating the same life as my parents. And I keep telling myself that is something I don't want to do. I don't want to get married early. I don't want to bring kids in this world unless I have a way to raise them with a better life. I didn't want to go to school because I saw my parents struggling a lot just to give us money for the bus. And sometimes we didn't even have that.
For us, it was a matter of you have to go to school, get good grades, graduate, go to college. But my aunts would also say, stay home, get married, and let your husband take care of you. But when I was in high school, I wasn't allowed to work. I was only supposed to go to school. I got married early. In fact, we eloped. We were only 18, and we had just graduated from high school. He was going to school, and I would go to nursing school up north. Well, everyone wanted us to get an annulment, but we refused to do it. And I immediately got pregnant and had a baby. Well, after that, I got a job at the airport. It was Host International at the time, and they were union. And it was the first and only job that I had outside of my family.
When I was 15 years old, my sister asked me to travel and live with her in TJ. I went. I start working as a house cleaner. Then my younger brother says he wants to cross the border. He's 2 years younger than I am, and we were taking care of each other. So when he decided to cross, I told him he's not going by himself. I told him I was going with him. And that's the way I came.
When I came over, it was by myself. I came to this country, to LA, in 1968. I cannot forget that year because when I arrived, it was when Robert Kennedy got shot at the Ambassador Hotel. So I never forget. I was 16 when I arrived. Changing from a small town in Mexico, I didn't like the city. I was in LA for 2 days. Then I decided to go to Northern California. I worked in the fields for pancreas. And I went over to see my brother. He was working over at the Century Plaza Hotel. And when I arrived at the hotel, he tells me, just go and get dressed and start working. We'll fill out the paperwork later. In those days, there was such a big demand for labor, they didn't really care whether people were legal to work or not. So that's how I got to the Century Plaza Hotel since 1970.
When I started out at Host, all I did was fix the trays. I put a napkin and a fork and a knife and salt and pepper on them, you know, stuff like that. The food comes out and I set it on the tray, give it to the waitress, and the waitress delivers it. I can't believe that was my first job. I made $1.85 an hour doing that.
I wasn't used to doing things by myself. I didn't know how things were done. I worked as a dishwasher for 6 months. Then they assigned me to help over in the kitchen. I'd get the equipment ready for the cooks and prepare silverware for the servers. Then I was promoted to a busboy. Later, they promote me to supervisor with a busboy team.
I moved up to a cashier. Then I got another job offered to become a pantry cook that catered to chartered flights at the airport. I was actually in charge of the terminal by the time we closed down. I'd also become a bartender while I was there, a lead bartender.
Me? Well, I'm a housekeeper. Cleaning the bedrooms. The guests leave the rooms really messy, and we need to give it our all to finish. My job has been the same since I arrived here. I started working in Minneapolis in a Radisson hotel. Well, my English didn't help me move up to a higher job. When I arrived in Los Angeles, I began to work again in cleaning the bedroom. And they didn't move me up because, again, my English was not very good. I got comfortable working there.
In 2000, I got this job at the Viceroy Hotel in Santa Monica. They assigned us to clean 17 rooms in 8 hours. I start off making the minimum wage, $6.50 back then, and no benefits, obviously. It was hard, especially when they give us a lot of guest checkouts. I have to work through my breaks, sometimes after we clock out.
I didn't like the way management treated the workers. They were not giving respect to the other workers the same way that I was getting it. And I felt like, this is not what I'm used to. I like to see people being respected. Then an organizer comes into the hotel and asks me, hey, Ignacio, do you want to come to a union meeting? I was not interested in the union because the administration was not. I didn't trust him. I'll say that. It was only run by one man, and he would come over into the hotel and sit down with the bosses and negotiate. And at the end of the night, he would say, oh, you got a raise for you, 10 cents. Then the union leadership changed. I went to the meeting and I noticed the training that's being given to the workers, how to represent other workers and empower them and to help them with issues on the job. And I felt that it was something interesting. A union organizer gives me a union button. He says, would you like to wear this button? And I say, sure. I don't know exactly what it means, but I feel good having this button on. Then at work, one of the managers asks, why are you wearing this button? Oh, the person from the union gave it to me. You know, we treat you real well here. Yeah, but I see things from a different perspective.
One of my coworkers, who was an organizer, came one day with a card, a union authorization card to sign. I asked, what's the signature for? And she says, so we can have better benefits. Well, I just signed the authorization card and I gave it to her. Then I heard bad things about the union. So I went back to look for her and ask her for my signature card back. She didn't want to give it to me. Instead, she started to explain why we need that card. I still didn't believe her because it took me so long to get that job. And I was afraid to lose that job. I said, I don't need the union. But she, well, why don't you come to this meeting and ask questions? And if you still don't believe me, then I'll give you your signature back. That was very convincing. So I went to the meeting. The first thing I asked the leader is, what are you doing for immigration? Is it true the union is helping deport people? Obviously, he said no and showed me one of the contracts that had very strong immigration protection language. Fine, you can keep the card then. I was very convinced. After that, the organizer came to my house to recruit me to be part of the organizing committee. I said, no, I didn't have a need to do that. But she was very persistent. She came to my house over and over again. She left me voice messages, went to the hotel to look for me. It got to the point where I thought she had nothing else to do but bother me. Until I gave her an appointment and we sat down. She learned that I was afraid to lose that job because it was hard for me to find that job. Then I learned the company's policy. I learned that I don't have job security unless I have a union contract. And in the meantime, they can fire me for any reason. That's when I said, oh my God, you're right, okay. I'm going to join the organizing committee. And that's how I started with the union. And then I went on to organize at the Radisson Hotel on Century Boulevard. Then the Glendale Hilton. And after that, one of my biggest and most challenging assignments, the Hilton LAX. and then the Embassy Suites in Irvine, and the Westin Long Beach, and then the Hyatt Long Beach, and then the Hilton Long Beach.
I saw so much injustice in my work, so much cruelty to people, so much discrimination, so much abuse. Okay, one day I see a manager and a coworker in housekeeping. The coworker needs a washcloth, but the manager takes one ahead of everyone else. And when the coworker says something, the manager throws the washcloth on the floor and tells my coworker to pick it up. I tell her, no, don't pick it up. You leave it right there on the floor. And she did. Yeah, from then on, I stepped up. I always step up for my people, for my coworkers. I decided to talk to some of them. I told them, I know of a union. I know that this union is good. The union will help. We are going to go there. We can't continue with our heads down. We have to lift our heads up. The employers are really unjust with us, and more with Latinos, because they know that we don't speak the language and that we need the money. And so they abuse us more. That's when I started to become a leader within my job.
They asked me if I could mobilize people. And I said, mobilize people? How does it work? We're going to have a rally. We're organizing the new Otani. How many people can you mobilize? I felt so confident. I said, how many do you need? They said, can you get 10? I think I can get at least 20 or more. So I go over and talk to them one by one. When the date comes for the action, they come over to me one by one. Hey, here I am. Here I am. Here I am. Aquí estoy. The organizers were looking at me like, what is this? Because you know how difficult it is to mobilize people. But at the end of the day, I had over 25 people. Then they asked me if I want to be a shop steward. They say, we're going to train you. We're going to empower you to delegate over at the hotel. You mean for me to go over and challenge management? I'm going to be in the face of management now and leading a delegation of workers? I wasn't sure to do it or not, but I got to meetings where they're sitting down and handling a grievance, and I see how things work. So I say, okay, I will do it. I will be a shop steward. And he's pushing me, you know, giving me assignments I'm not used to doing over in the hotel. And he says, okay, go over there and challenge the human resources director. So I do it. At the beginning, it was tough because they were not used to having people go over and telling them, hey, this is not proper what you're doing. This doesn't make sense. It took time for me to break this barrier. But once I got over it, I felt, this is great.
I was a single mom with two girls, 7 years apart. So when I really started getting active with the union, their lives changed. My aunt was there to take care of them, but they didn't appreciate the time I spent with the union. And not just my daughters, but my sisters and my brothers and my aunts and my uncle. Frankly, they said I was participating in a cult, that I had been brainwashed.
At first, my family was just like me. They didn't know anything about the union. We were just so limited about what we were going to do here as immigrants. You know, we just let the bosses do whatever they want. My older sister was against me. She didn't want me to become involved with the union.
When I was assigned my first campaign, I was out for a whole year, out on a union leave from my work at the Century Plaza. My wife never expected me to be out that long. Well, we had just finished negotiations with the Century Plaza, and they tell me, we need you to go over to Oxnard and help with the strawberry workers. I told my wife, oh, I'm going over to Oxnard and be there for 3 months, 6 months. I don't know. She got upset. I never realized that I was putting my marriage on the line. It took time. Later, my wife realized that I was doing the right thing. Now I just get up like this morning and say, I'm going to the union. And she says, oh, okay.
Well, later on, my daughter said she understood. She became a shop steward herself. My oldest daughter is a nurse, and she understands because she worked for a company that wasn't union. But because of the way she was and because of the things I taught her, she's now very pro-union. They finally came to understand the importance of what it is to be union and how important it is to fight for your rights.
I did a hunger strike for 7 days. I said, one day I am going to feel happy about what I am doing. Well, those 7 days was hard. My blood sugar dropped. I got skinny. I didn't care. I went on fighting. And in the end, I saw victory. My kids also see me as a leader. They feel happy because they know that I'm a fighter, that I fight for what I love.
Now they look up to me. My sister, she's seen me change, not just my language and personality, but also financially. That's when they start to learn what the union really does. My brothers now, if their bosses don't want to give them their pay, or the first person that they call is me, what am I supposed to do? Are they supposed to do this? Most of them started driving when they saw me start driving. They get motivation from me. They say, if she can do it, we can do it.
My proudest moment was at the Westin when all the union authorization cards were signed and counted. And for me, that was it. I cried. Well, I cry about everything, but I cry seeing that my efforts are not in vain, that it is possible.
The power that the housekeeping department has is incredible. I have seen it. Yeah, there was this convention at the Hyatt, and for some reason, the hotel decided to overload the rooms with pillows. And the housekeepers got so upset, they said,
no, we're going to take those pillows out and leave them in the halls.
We are not going up to the rooms until you remove all those pillows, because you never negotiated with the union.
Management refused, so the housekeepers walked out. They stayed out on the picket line for almost 3 hours. And the hotel ended up paying all that time for close to 90 housekeepers that were standing there. Those are the things that empower the workers.
What I'm most proud of is when we did our first big campaign for Host, I had to talk close friends and coworkers into giving up on a raise that they would get an order for someone else who made less money to get a raise. That made me feel the best, to get somebody to realize that they need to help pull somebody else up. By pulling them up, they have to get a little less. But they're willing to do it, and you help convince somebody that it was the right thing to do.
We've changed the whole fight for people to get out of poverty. It is incredible. I think one day I was driving to my hotel and I saw a huge billboard that says, new minimum wage covers 800,000 poor people in the city. And right away I realized it is my union, Local 11, doing it. We have changed the lives of our people.
I see it big. I see it big. I see all the hotels. I want to see them like Las Vegas. I want all the hotel workers to feel like we feel ourselves. I wish to fix the world in that way.
And to share what we have learned with others.
And in telling your story, your life story, how you've taken charge, how you've moved ahead, and how you've done this, it helped other people realize that they can do the same thing.
Thanks to Emma Worthington, Regla Soto, Soledad Garcia, and Ignacio Ruiz for sharing their stories. Changing Lives, Changing LA was conceived by veteran organizer Vivian Rothstein and crafted by playwrights Doris Baisley and Rose Portillo. It was directed by Rose Portillo and Doris Baisley and produced by Vivian Rothstein. The oral histories of the women and men of Unite Here Local 11 were voiced by actors Joyce Guy, Marco Rodriguez, Rose Portillo, and Sarita Ocon. For access to the Unite Here Local 11 oral history interviews, please visit tinyurl.com/Unite Here Oral History. To watch a video recording of the play, please visit tinyurl.com/Changing Lives, Changing LA. The video recording was edited by Robert Hillig. And lastly, thanks to all the individuals and organizations who made this episode possible. Thanks for listening. Until next time, rethink, rework.
From the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to America Worked, interviews with contemporary workers throughout the United States collected by the Library's American Folklife Center as part of its Occupational Folklife Project. This is AFC staff folklorist Nancy Gross, and this America Works episode features excerpts from a longer interview with Rosemary Frances Primo, a home health care aide in Brooklyn, New York. She's a proud member of Domestic Workers United, an advocacy organization that represents Caribbean, Latina, and African nannies, housekeepers, home workers, and caregivers in metropolitan New York. For this project, folklorist Christopher Mulet and DWU members Christine Lewis and Patricia Francois interviewed more than 20 domestic workers whose hard work and occupational experiences are all too frequently overlooked.
When I came into this country, I came and taught in the daycare. And it was some excellent years. After that, I got into when the daycare folded up because of other daycares coming in, and I was introduced to the healthcare system. I took care of elderly people, basically elderly people, people that has all sorts of illnesses, and try to, you know, encourage them in their illnesses and to support them, because a lot of them too, they don't have the family support, and you, the healthcare provider now, becomes like that daughter, becomes like that mother for these sick people. The healthcare, I've been doing this like, let me see, about 11, 12 years. So you have to pray and ask God guidance that when you leave your home and arrive to their place or where they are, you would be able to sustain yourself and give of your best to them. Because sometimes you leave them one way, and by the time you get back to the next, it's a different person. You know, they may become ill during the course of the night. They have to go into the hospital. You know, they become in pain. And you have to know how to shift. You're always shifting the lane. When I get there, I check the environment. I check them to see that they're okay. I question them. And then I offer them to see if they have their breakfast done, if they remember to do what they have to do, if they're, you know, allowed to do certain things for themselves. And we just communicate and play, walk with them, keep them clean, keep them safe until you are ready. I would question them, how was your night? where did you go? Because sometimes we leave them with other relatives. And I get them to talk. The objective is to get them to discuss and to talk. So you know when something is not in line, you, the caregiver, can pick it up right away. If something is extraordinary or unusual, I would call in the coordinator or the case manager and let them know that I find this unusual and if they can send someone to investigate it. You have to have a good communicative skills, number one. You have to have patience, because not always it's going to be the way you want it. And you must be able to pick up the challenge without questioning. It's there and it has to be done. And you just put yourself in place and get it done. You're going to someone's home and you have to learn their principles and accept it. If not, you just leave if you can't work with it. But it's better to work with it, and it makes your day better, because then now you are able now to communicate better with the client. Okay, and then it's making your day easier. We are becoming a force to be reckoned with.
Yes.
So look out, men. Look out, women. For Black women, we have come a long way.
You've been listening to an interview with home health care aide Rosemary Frances Primo. To hear the complete interview with Ms. Frances Primo, as well as interviews with more domestic workers and hundreds of other contemporary American workers, please visit the library's Occupational Folklife Project at www.loc.gov/folklife, or just search online for the Occupational Folklife Project. This is AFC staff folklorist Nancy Gross. On behalf of the American Folklife Center, and with special thanks to AFC intern Brian Jenkins for his help with this episode, thank you for listening to America Works.
This has been a presentation of the Library of Congress. Visit us at loc.gov.
Six construction workers are missing and presumed dead after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed early Tuesday morning. It's a grim reminder that despite the efforts of the American labor movement to make our workplaces safer, there is a long history of workplace death and injuries.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1947. That was the day Centralia Coal Mine No. 5 exploded, killing 111 miners in Centralia, Illinois. The explosion occurred just as the day shift was ending. Those not killed instantly were trapped and died from their burns or the afterdamp. Words scrawled on the wall of the mine read, "Look in our pockets. We all have notes. Please give them to our wives." State inspectors had been forewarning mine owners about the dangers of accumulated combustible coal dust for years before the explosion, but were ignored. Illinois Mine Inspector Driscoll Scanlon had been filing reports since 1942 about deteriorating conditions. The demand for coal during wartime had increased production at the expense of safety. In the aftermath of the explosion, John L. Lewis, president of the United Mine Workers of America, called a work stoppage in memory of the dead miners. He also held Secretary of the Interior Julius Krug guilty of criminal negligence. Lewis accused Krug of having failed to enforce existing mine regulations. In response, Krug ordered that 518 mines remain closed for inspection. The House and Senate proceeded to organize hearings on mine safety. They demanded that the Bureau of Mines continue to pass inspection findings onto the proper state agencies. Given the power mine owners had at the state level, these instructions ensured no improvements in mine safety would occur. It would be another 22 years before any real change occurred at the federal level.
It happened an hour ago, way down in this tunnel of coal. The gas caught fire from somebody's lamp, and the miners are choking in smoke.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
Freedom of speech, freedom to say
to think this is my lucky day.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the Labor Heritage Power Hour. If you've got suggestions for guests or topics for future shows, drop us a note. info@laborheritage.org. The Labor Heritage Power Hour is a proud founding member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. laborradionetwork.org.
Today's show was produced by me, Chris Garlock, and engineered by Mike Nasella and Kalia Chapman here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
Thanks so much for listening to the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
The art and soul of the American labor movement.
And I agree. Hold out your hand to me. We will share our freedoms with our friends and family.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee heard arguments today on whether the Georgia election subversion case against former President Donald Trump should be dismissed. An Atlanta grand jury in August 2023 indicted Trump and 18 others on state charges stemming from their alleged efforts to overturn the former president's 2020 electoral defeat. Trump's attorney argued that his actions were political speech and advocacy and are protected by the First Amendment. Prosecutors argued that the communication from Trump related to the charges is not protected and that his lies furthered a criminal conspiracy. The judge did not issue a ruling, but the district attorney still hopes to go to trial before the presidential election. In related news, a judge with the State Bar of California recommended yesterday that John Eastman, a former attorney for Donald Trump, be disbarred for his role in promoting false claims and legal strategies aimed at keeping Donald Trump in power after the 2020 election. The judge found that Eastman willfully misrepresented facts and violated his ethical duties as an attorney. According to a statement released by the California State Bar, his actions, quote, threatened the fundamental principles of our democracy, close quote. The judge ordered that Eastman's law license be put on involuntary inactive status, effective 3 days after her ruling. The California Supreme Court will issue a final ruling on the matter, which Eastman can appeal. In other news, the bodies of two of the six construction workers who died after a cargo ship hit a pillar of Baltimore's Key Bridge have been recovered. Four other workers are still unaccounted for and presumed dead. Officials said they were pausing the search for more bodies as their focus turns to clearing debris. Meanwhile, the flow of ships in and out of the Port of Baltimore has been halted indefinitely. The Biden administration pledged an aggressive effort to reopen the port, which handles up to $200 million worth of cargo on a typical day. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg plans to meet today with shippers and supply chain operators as his office seeks to mitigate the disruptions to one of the East Coast's most active ports. Another emerging concern is that hazardous material may be leaking from some of the containers on the ship. Based on the cargo manifest, the NTSB has determined the ship was carrying 56 containers of hazardous material. Authorities have observed a sheen on the waterway indicating potential leakage. The environmental impact is still unclear. And Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years in prison today for his role in the collapse of the crypto exchange FTX. Bankman-Fried was convicted in November of stealing more than $8 billion and engaging his employees in a years-long cover-up, in what prosecutors have called one of the largest financial frauds in U.S. history. U.S. District Judge Lewis Kaplan today rejected Bankman-Fried's claim that FTX customers did not actually lose money. The judge also said Bankman-Fried lied during his trial testimony when he said he